Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, happy Easter. In the first half of the first century AD, there took place probably the single best known event in all human history. There are four main accounts, all written decades afterwards, and this is one of them. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe upon him. And plaiting a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spat upon him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they'd mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. As they went out, they came upon a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. This man they compelled to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink mingled with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." So Tom Holland, that's a story with which we and a large proportion, probably almost all of our listeners, are extremely familiar. And there are all kinds of conversations we could have about the historicity of this, about whether Jesus really existed, about whether this really happened. But what we wanted to focus on today was the act of crucifixion itself. Because obviously, when we think of the crucifixion, we think of Jesus. But presumably at the time, Tom, I mean, you'll know far more about this than me, crucifying somebody would not have been unusual, would it, in the Roman world?
No, crucifixion was a very common form of execution. And it was a form of execution that was, it was basically seen as the absolute worst that you could inflict. So as a governor of a province, if you were faced with rebellion, banditry, insurrection, you could inflict a range of punishments. So you could burn someone to death. You could put them to the beasts. So make them a public show in the arena and people would cheer as they watched them devoured by wild animals, or you could crucify them. And crucifixion was seen as the worst of these fates because it was protracted and humiliating, even more humiliating than being burnt to death or devoured by lions. And it was that idea of being made a public spectacle that I think reflects the way in which, for the Romans, to be shamed was almost as terrible as to be tortured. And that's why, as well as being the paradigmatic fate that was visited on rebels, it was also the paradigmatic fate that was visited on slaves. So
when Jesus, I mean, we'll come back to Jesus' crucifixion, but he's been crucified as a sign of humiliation, as a sign, yes, that he is no more than a slave. And that's why the King of the Jews stuff is so is bitterly ironic, I suppose.
Absolutely. So it was crucifixion is called supplicium servile by a Roman writer called Valerius Maximus, the punishment of slaves. Josephus, the Jewish writer who records the war that destroys Jerusalem, he calls it the most wretched of deaths. Even a grammarian called Varro, he writes about the crux, the cross, and he says that the word of it is harsh on the ears. So everything about it is cruel, savage, bitter. And that generates a kind of paradox, which is that although, as you say, it's incredibly common, and it's something that serves the Roman world as an emblem of Rome's power, it's a statement about Rome's authority, about its right to inflict brutal torture on those who oppose them. It's also something that the Romans themselves seem to have been a bit embarrassed about. They didn't like to draw attention to it. Crucifixions don't happen in the center of town. So in the account you read, Golgotha, which is otherwise unattested, is a place presumably outside the city limits. And in Rome itself, crucifixions took place on a remote area that of the Esquiline Hill, that only very gradually, as Rome expands, gets kind of developed. But for a long time, it has this kind of taint. And that Carian taint, which hangs over crucifixion, means that the Romans themselves are actually very reluctant to acknowledge that it's a Roman practice. So they say, yes, we do it, but this is a practice that has its origins among barbarians. So it's...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get back to the root of it. So when, Tom, do we get our first references to crucifixions? It predates the empire, presumably.
It does. It's complicated, though, because we think of, you know, crucifixion as a kind of set practice, that there are set rules and so on. It's hard to know whether that's the case. The only accounts we have of an actual crucifixion by the Romans are the four gospel accounts, which in itself is telling, I think. The Romans are reluctant to go into all the gory details. And if we go back before the Romans, there are various accounts, chiefly by Greek writers, of penalties that seem to involve suspending someone, hanging them, putting them up in a public place and suspending them from a tree or a piece of wood. And so this fate could be crucifixion as we understand it, in the sense that, that Christians would understand it today, but it could also be impalement or something like that.
So I have a question, Tom. Friend of the show, Alexander the Great, mm-hmm. is said to have crucified large numbers of people after capturing the city of Tyre.
Yeah.
Because he was cross, they wouldn't let him in to worship a statue of Heracles.
Yeah.
Because of course the accounts of Alexander that we have are written later. So is that putting back a sort of Roman practice and thinking that he must have done it? Or is it plausible that Alexander was crucifying people and that was a common practice in the 4th century BC?
I think it's likelier to be an actual reflection of what he did, because Alexander is invading the Persian Empire and he is taking on the role of a Persian king. And crucifixion, or at least suspending people, impaling people, hanging them from, in public so that they suffer and die in public, is seen as something that originates with the Persians.
So Ali Ansari, who's been a guest on the show many times, and says everything began with the Persians, will be delighted to hear that crucifixion top tortures are among them.
The Persians are famous for the sophistication and subtlety of their torture. And much, much later, the Marquis de Sade, who is a guy who really knows what he's talking about when it comes to torture, says that the Persians, of all the peoples who have ever lived, were the greatest at torturing people to death. And the idea that you punish rebels by exposing them to humiliation, the humiliating gaze, is something that certainly goes back to Darius the Great, who is ruling. He's the king who sends the expedition that gets defeated at the Battle of Marathon, the expedition to destroy Athens. And he comes to power amid a coup, and all kinds of Persian provinces, cities rebel against him, and among them is Babylon. And Darius takes 3,000 Babylonians and he crucifies them, or which could, as I say, mean, you know, he impales them. But certainly this is remembered. This is a kind of kingly thing to do. This is what the great king does. So I imagine that Alexander, you know, that there is an echo of that behavior.
So a slightly pedantic question. You said he crucifies them, which may mean that he impales them. So that implies to me that the word, the original word that is being used, is not the word crucify, right? That it's some other translation or some other word that could mean crucifixion, but could mean something else. Is that right? That there's some sort of vague intermediate term?
Well, a stavros. That's where the Greek name comes from.
That's where the word stavros comes from.
Yeah, exactly. Is a cross. It's conventionally translated as a cross, but it could be a pole. It's hard because crucifixion becomes so famous and because the role it plays in Christianity is so key. It kind of, you know, we tend to back project that what happens there onto the earlier use of it by Greek writers. We can't know for sure. It could be a kind of range of things. But the key thing is that you are exposed to public obloquy, and that is absolutely the fundamental aspect of it, and it's what makes the crucifixion, with a capital C, so extraordinary and strange that this should be the foundational image. Because obviously for Christians, you know, the key to Easter is the resurrection. It's the rising from the dead. That's the whole essence of the story. But that in terms of antiquity is not so unusual. Lots of mortals are raised up to the heavens. You know, in the lifetime of Jesus, Augustus Caesar has been raised up to the heavens. Augustus Caesar's adoptive father, Julius Caesar, has been raised to the heavens. There are all kinds of gods who die and then get raised from the dead.
Yeah. And obviously ancient Egyptian religion is full of this, isn't it?
Yes.
Is this what happens to Osiris or Horus or somebody?
Yeah. So Osiris gets killed, loses his penis, which is obviously something that doesn't happen to Jesus. And then he gets resurrected to rule as the king of the dead.
Yeah.
So this is all very common.
But it's the humiliation that is unusual. Right?
That is the strangeness. That is the weirdness. And until you properly understand its significance in the Roman imagination and in the Greek imagination and indeed in the Jewish imagination, you don't properly understand how strange the whole thing is.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the Romans and crucifixion. So do we have any sense, Tom, of the kind of people and the kind of crimes for which you would be crucified?
Yeah, so as I said, it's chiefly visited on rebels against Roman rule in the provinces and on slaves. And it comes to serve as, therefore, a kind of warning to anyone, be they a slave rebelling against the master or a provincial rebelling against the power of Caesar, of what your fate will be. And one of the weirdest expressions of this is in the writings of Pliny the Elder,
You love a bit of Pliny.
I love a bit of Pliny. For the new book I'm doing, I've been reading through all his natural history, which is this incredible kind of compendium of all kinds of sometimes very, very accurate facts and sometimes not entirely accurate. And he covers, you know, natural phenomena and...
It's like this podcast, Tom.
Well, no, you're very against natural phenomena, aren't you? So he loves his birds, for instance, which you're very hostile to.
We were already talking before recording this about whether we should do a podcast on the history of birds.
Well, we're doing one with pigeons, of course.
I reacted with incredulity, but ornithological fans will be horrified to hear this.
So, but among them, he talks about animals and he talks about the lion as the king of the lions, and he has this extraordinary story about how Polybius, who is a Greek who accompanied Scipio Aemilianus, who destroyed Carthage in 146 BC, that he was with Scipio in Africa. And he saw Scipio crucify lions so that the other lions, Pliny writes, would be deterred from attacking the cities of Africa by fear of suffering the same fate.
That seems absolutely horrible and bizarre.
Isn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
is it plausible that he did that?
Well, it's in Pliny, so.
and also, Tom, would it act as a deterrent to other lions?
I think it's unlikely. But obviously, what it would do would act as a deterrent to people in Africa.
I'm more shocked by that than I am by the crucifixion of thousands of people that we've talked about earlier in the podcast.
Well, there's another crucifixion of animals story, which is the famous account of the Gauls who capture Rome, seize Rome, and they occupy the city, but the Capitol holds out, and the Gauls are creeping up the side of the rock to try and storm the top, and the watchdogs don't bark. But the sacred geese of Juno, the queen of the gods, hiss and alert the guards. Nice. And so every year that on the anniversary of that day, the geese are put in a litter and carried in triumph through the city. But the watchdogs are crucified. I mean, it's
what, through no like subsequent generations of dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes Jeremy Thorpe look positively.
No. Well, we haven't had dogs being killed for a while, so that's as it were terrible. Resurrecting the tradition.
Very good. That's a terrible story. Now, the reason I asked about who was crucified and why was because and when you answered that, both of the examples you gave were about rebels. So you're not crucified by and large for a common or garden crime, even a murder. It's rebellion against it's a crime against the state, against a threat to the integrity of the state. Is it that is punishable by
and the natural order,
right?
So you do if you're a slave and you kill your master, then not only are you crucified, but everyone in the household is crucified.
That again is ridiculously harsh.
Well, so this happens. I'm trying to remember. It's Tacitus writes about it. I think it's in the reign of Nero that. A senator is murdered by one of his slaves, and there's something like kind of five, he has 500, 600 slaves, something like that, with women and children. And actually, even the Romans are appalled at the prospect of, you know, all these slaves who are entirely innocent being killed. And there is a kind of, there's a kind of brief campaign to say, well, do we really need to do this? But they decide, yeah, we do. So the whole lot get crucified.
Wow. That is. I was about to say that's tough love, but there's no love in it.
No, there's no love in that at all.
It's just tough.
No, it's just tough. Yeah.
What about obviously the most famous crucified slave, certainly in the Western, in the modern Western imagination, is Spartacus. Mm-hmm. Was Spartacus crucified?
Well, he's supposed to have been killed in the final battle. Obviously, if you go along with the Kirk Douglas film, then he isn't because. You know, everyone turns out to be Spartacus, and so they all get they all get crucified. But the point of that, of course, is that the context for this is that Rome's conquest of the Mediterranean has generated an incredible amount of enslavement. Huge numbers of people have been enslaved, and among them, of course, are barbarians who are seen by Greeks as well as by Romans to be fitted for servitude, and therefore Greeks and Romans tend not to worry about that particularly. But also among the people enslaved are Greeks who do not see themselves as a fit people to be enslaved. And so they are brought to Italy and to Sicily. And it's not like they are objecting to slavery as an institution. They're objecting to the fact that they are the slaves. That's the problem. And so through the second and first centuries BC, you have large numbers of slave insurrections. And they get dealt with incredibly brutally because maybe a quarter, maybe a third of the population of Italy by this point are slaves. So the Romans are sitting on, you know, the edge of a volcano.
So this is very analogous to the situation in 19th century American South.
Yes.
Where you've got you've got a large slave population. People live in a constant state of they're either brutalized or terrorized on the one hand, or they're the owners who live in fear of insurrection.
Yes.
On the other, and are therefore driven to extremes.
Yes, and so therefore it becomes incredibly important that every slave absolutely understand what will happen if they in any way try and fight back. And so when Spartacus's rebellion is finished, famously, those who survive are crucified along the entire length of the Appian Way, which is across Italy to the heel of Italy. And these are serving as kind of billboards advertising Rome's power. That's what they're there for. And it's meant to be a kind of disgusting spectacle.
Yeah, which it must have been. I mean, so let's talk a tiny bit about the mechanics of crucifixion. Do we know much about that? Or are our sole accounts, you said earlier on, if I heard you correctly, that the our sole accounts really are the gospel accounts. So when historians write about crucifixion now, are they actually basing it on the Bible?
It's very, very difficult to escape it. There is physical evidence for it. So the earliest physical evidence was found in 1968, and it was in a tomb outside Jerusalem. It wasn't Jesus, for anyone right. wonders about that. It was someone a bit later. And what that shows is, so it's the heel bone, and there's a nail driven through it, and it's still attached to the wood. And what that shows is, so if you imagine, you know, how the crucifixion is portrayed in Christian art, the feet are crossed and a nail is kind of driven through the feet or maybe through the ankles.
Through both your ankles at once.
Yeah, but what this shows is that your the side of the cross, the feet are put on either side of the cross and then they're driven through the ankle. Again, I mean, that would, of course, enhance the humiliation of the experience because you wouldn't be wearing a loincloth. So your legs would be spread. You'd be naked. Yeah, you'd be naked. And corroboration for that was actually found just before Christmas in Britain. So,
oh, yes, you sent me the story. Yeah, you sent it from The Guardian because I know you're a massive admirer of The Guardian. And they found, so tell us about what they found.
Yes, so a whole kind of cemetery was excavated and the bones were removed. And then it was only, I think, you know, last year that they washed the mud off and they discovered the same thing had happened, that there was a nail embedded in the through the ankle. And this was, you know, clearly this unfortunate had suffered crucifixion. However, I mean, there's no firm or fast rule on this because it's perfectly possible that people were suspended by ropes. And in fact, Seneca in an account, well, he says that part of the fun of it for the executioners is to kind of spice it up, to vary it. So he says that, you know, one victim may be suspended upside down with his head facing the ground. Others, you know, in the classical sense, you know, the image of Jesus with the arms spread along a yoke. Others, he says, I mean, horribly, and so this is where the confusion between crucifixion and impalement comes in, that people might drive a stake up through the genitals. So it's the variation of this seems to be important. So there's an account that Josephus writes about as the Romans are besieging Jerusalem. And they're trying to intimidate the defenders, and all the deserters, all the people who are kind of trying to slip out, who are armed, who are captured. They're crucified in front of the walls of the defenders to try and intimidate them. And Josephus describes how the soldiers, out of their hostility to the defending Jews, out of their hatred to them, that they kind of mix and match, that they will twist their victims into kind of strange positions, that basically it's a bit of a laugh. And so in the account from the gospel that you read, where they mock Jesus, that seems entirely true to the evidence that we have for how the military, the security apparatus dealt with their victims. That in a sense, making the victim look ridiculous and grotesque and foolish was a crucial part of the punishment. The more amusing you could make it, the kind of more credit you get with your colleagues.
Now, Tom, you haven't really answered my question about, in fact, you've utterly failed to answer the question.
What was the question?
The question was about how crucifixions worked in practice. So what do we actually know? So let's, in that biblical account, a man carries a cross. There's a big crowd, presumably. There's all the stuff with later on with sponges. There's a whole sort of there's a whole load of goings on. What do we actually know about what a crucifixion, an ordinary crucifixion, was like?
To reiterate, there is no standard procedure. But having said that, discounting the gospel accounts, the evidence is that before the before you were crucified, you were very likely to be whipped. And the whip would be probably one with, so it'd be like kind of cat-o'-nine-tails with chunks of metal on the tip. So it would
scourge you.
Yeah, it would gouge out chunks of your flesh. So it would be unspeakably painful. So that then, and then you would be paraded through the streets. You would have to carry, absolutely, you would carry your, maybe not the bulk of the cross, but what was called the cross beam. And you would carry what was called a titulus, which was the description of your crime around your neck, so that people could read why it was that you were being crucified.
Tom, it's very Christian of you to be, it's interesting how you imagine yourself to be the crucified. I was thinking you would tell it from the crucifier's perspective.
Yes, I know. I'm portraying 2,000 years of Christian weathering there.
You are.
Yeah, I think the experience of crucifixion is obviously more vivid for the crucified than for the crucifier, I think.
Yeah, for the crucifier, so, it's just another working day.
It's just, well, and it is another working day. So that's another kind of fascinating aspect of it, is that we have an account of, they're kind of like an agency. They're like a kind of torture agency. That if you're a city council or something and you've got to, you know, do your crucifixion.
They outsource it.
They outsource it. And there's a kind of advert from, you know, saying, all your crucifixion needs. we'll do the torturing. You know, we'll burn them if you want. We'll gouge out the eyes if you like. That's fine.
Do you have a selection of packages you can sign up?
Exactly. Exactly. So we have that. And so that's how we know that, you know, there is a kind, you know, as you say, there are kind of various packages that you can have. So you could have them whipped. You can have them maybe blinded. You can have them maimed beforehand. And, you know, these are all options. Now, if you don't blind the victim before he goes up on the cross, then the likelihood is that fairly soon birds will come and peck out the eyes.
Oh, come on.
Because there's nothing you can do to stop them. And probably your genitals as well. They'll cluster around your genitals and your eyes and attack them. And we actually have documentary evidence for this from the Talmud, which in a commentary on the book of Genesis, and this is the account of the fans of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat will remember. I think is it the butler? No, it's the baker. It's the baker ends up crucified. He dreams that he's on a tree. He's hanging from a tree. And right. This is interpreted as presaging his crucifixion. And in this, the commentary on it, in the Talmud, it says that birds will eat the flesh from your head, which is presumably the eyes, because that's the kind of the softest material. So, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible detail. And Josephus also describes how birds flock around.
Just before you get on with your torture porn, Tom, you said he for the person being put on the cross. Are they always men?
I think almost invariably. So the slaves in the house that I mentioned in the reign of Nero, the women would have been executed as well. But it does seem to have been a distinctively suffered by men. So how long are you up on the cross? That entirely depends. You know, you could be there for days. And in a way, so I'm not a doctor, so I'm not entirely sure of the mechanics of it, but it is said that part of the torture is that you constantly have to lift yourself up because otherwise you'll suffocate for reasons that I'm not entirely clear and that I gather are contested by medical people. But if that's the case, then, you know, you're in a constant kind of seesawing motion. You know, you've got your birds that are pecking out your eyes, your body is kind of gouged out with this awful whip, people are gawping at you, your genitals are on display, and you're heaving yourself up and down. So I mean, it's a repellent, horrible, horrible fate. And so that's why often people will break the leg as an act of mercy, because then you will suffocate and die and your agony will be over. And then when your agony is over, you'll be taken down from the cross, and the likelihood is that you will not be buried in a tomb. So, the guy who was found outside Jerusalem was unusual. Jesus is unusual in this sense. The likelihood is that you will be carted away and chucked into a common tomb, and that is part of the punishment. So, in Italy, if you have the deluxe torture package, you will have people who are dressed up in red, carrying bells, who will drag the bodies to the carrion tip, ringing bells as they go.
And does anybody survive?
Well, that's a good question. So Josephus, again, who is, by this point, although he's a Jew, he's kind of a pal with Titus, who is the Roman general who is commanding the war against the Jews. He asks Titus for a favor if some of his friends can be taken down from the crosses, and Titus says fine, and they get taken down, and they still die, and they haven't been up for very long. So from the evidence of that, the likelihood is that, you know, even a few hours are going to be so excruciating and agonizing that you're going to die of it.
Yeah.
So just to reiterate, this is the most horrible of deaths, and it's the most humiliating of deaths. That's its significance in the Christian story. I think, you know, culturally, it's far more significant than the fact that Jesus rises, that his believers believe him, he rises from the dead, is the fact that he has first suffered this horrific death.
And that's what makes him as unique at that point in the kind of the pantheon of Near Eastern Mediterranean gods.
I think not just then, I think now. I mean, I think it is absolutely exceptional, and it explains so much that has made Christianity so culturally distinctive.
Okay. Well, Tom, we'll take a break to allow the listeners to have a stiff drink, which they'll probably need after all that. Because after all that that gore and gruesomeness, we're going to get stuck into the greatest story ever told, the crucifixion of Jesus specifically, and then what happened to the practice of crucifixion after that, and of course, arguably the most resonant symbol in all human history, the cross. So we'll see you for all that after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. In the run-up to Easter, we're talking about crucifixion, and we've talked about the practice of crucifixion and the emphasis on humiliation and the sheer horror of the experience of being crucified. And Tom, I started this podcast with an account from the Gospel of, according to St. Matthew, almost certainly, according to biblical scholars, I think, not written by St. Matthew, the crucifixion of Jesus. So there are a lot of elements that are in all four Gospels. It's an extraordinary thing that we have this event from the first century AD, a sort of fly-bitten part of the Roman Empire, four different sources. And of course, there are others. There are other kind of apocryphal gospels and stuff, aren't there? So we have this, how true do you think these accounts are? Or can we not talk about that in any meaningful way, about the veracity or accuracy of these accounts of Jesus' crucifixion?
Well, so there is a kind of there is a movement in biblical criticism called mythicism, which implies that the whole Jesus never existed. The whole thing is just a kind of riff on, you know, vegetation gods. Gods live, die, come back to life, all that kind of stuff.
Jesus is Osiris or whatever.
Yes, or Adonis or that kind of thing. I think that is mad. I think that is the kind of atheist equivalent of creationism. it's putting the cart of what you want to believe in front of the horse of the evidence. And the evidence, I think, for the fact that Jesus was crucified is pretty strong. Okay. And I will cite a scholar, Geza Vermes, who is generally quite skeptical about the Gospels as historical evidence. But he says that the death of Jesus of Nazareth on the cross is an established fact, arguably the only established fact about him. So that's the measure of how skeptical he is. And as he points out, it's attested in the four Gospels, very detailed mm-hmm. accounts. It's attested in the Acts of the Apostles. It's attested in the letters of Paul. It's attested outside the New Testament, almost certainly by Josephus, although we won't get into, we'll save that for the historical Jesus episode, whether Josephus does actually write about Jesus. I think he does, but it's a kind of complicated issue. Tacitus mentions it. It's alluded to in the Talmud. So I think it is very, very well attested. And I think more importantly than that, it's just not the kind of thing that anyone would have had any interest in making up.
Yes, because it's not a recommendation for your God, is it? If you're going to invent a God.
It's absolutely not. And I think the evidence for so we've talked about the Gospels, the four Gospels, but actually the really key evidence, if we're looking for, what about the crucifixion narratives might be historical, is actually the earliest texts written by a Christian, which are the letters of Paul.
Yeah.
And when you read Paul's letters, what becomes immediately vivid is that for Paul, the fact that Jesus suffered death on a cross is an enormous embarrassment, and that the embarrassment for Paul is entirely the point, that he's obviously kind of wrestled with the strangeness of it and the weirdness of it, and in a sense has kind of made it the basis for his entire explanation for who Jesus was and what happened. So I think that is absolutely fun. If you want, it's biblical criticism. It's the same as with all history. You look for the closest source. Yeah. And in that sense, Paul's letters are really, really important.
Because they're written within, a couple of decades of the...
Yes, yes. But also, interestingly, people say, well, he doesn't really talk about the passion. Wouldn't he do, wouldn't he talk about it? Well, no, because he's writing to people whom it's evident already know the story.
Yeah.
So this is, it's clear that this is quite a... this is a story that people know about, that Christians know about, and I suspect that non-Christians know about as well. Because clearly there was considerable public interest in Jesus's fate. Mm-hmm. He for someone who claims to be king of the Jews to be crucified by the Romans outside Jerusalem, in what's a very prominent place in Jewish life, it would have been noticed. It's not the kind of thing that I think. So, and if you look at Paul's letters and you try and kind of extrapolate from that, what can we work out from Paul's letters about the passion? I think that you can see that he was crucified.
Yep.
That he was condemned by the Romans. That he had nails driven through his body. That he was buried. And those, I think, kind of sustain the basic historicity of the Gospel accounts. Now, the more I've looked at it, the more I've thought about it, the more I've reflected on it, the more I've come to think that in its essentials, the Gospel accounts are accurate. And one of the ways to sift that is that you look at the narratives, and if there are elements within it that seem to be the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, so in other words, to echo prophecies that have been made in what Christians call the Old Testament, Jews call the Tanakh, doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong, because obviously you can cast things in biblical terms, absolute historical things that have happened in biblical terms. It doesn't mean that they're ahistorical, but it perhaps means that they're less likely. So a kind of classic example of that is the account in the Gospels that at noon, the sky goes dark. That's first of all, meteorologically improbable.
Right.
And secondly, it seems to echo a verse in the book of Amos. On that day, says the Lord God, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight.
So, Tom, doesn't it seem like the kind of element that you put into, I don't want to sound like a kind of Hollywood filmmaker, but a sort of semi-apocalyptic moment you make the sky go dark because that's kind of what the audience expects, and it's the kind of grand statement of divine significance.
Yes, exactly. That, of course, is the moment when friend of the show John Wayne, as the Roman centurion in the great story ever told, the great story.
Gosh. Are you going to treat us like,
truly this man was the son of God? And Cecil B. DeMille, the director, says to him, could you put in a bit more awe, John, into your pronunciation of that? And so he says, or truly this man was the son of God. Great story. Wow. Anyway,
I didn't think we'd be getting John Wayne in this podcast, but it's always a pleasure.
So on that basis, one way perhaps of sifting the stories is to look at stuff that doesn't have, you know, biblical foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Of which I think that there are certain obvious aspects. So one we've already mentioned, which is the torture and the mockery before the crucifixion. That absolutely seems to go with the grain of Roman practice. And it should be added that when I say that Roman soldiers are doing it, these aren't actually probably Romans. They're probably not legionaries. They're probably recruited from Samaria, meaning that these soldiers are Samaritans. So, and people will know from the parable of the Good Samaritan, the whole point of that story is that Jews and Samaritans kind of hate each other. And so that's a kind of a shading to the story that often isn't drawn out.
Tom, can I just interject before you get back into the list of elements? For those people who don't know, what has Jesus been crucified for?
Okay, so this is another thing that I think is probably true. So that the titular, and that has the thing that Jesus is the King of the Jews written in the three languages, so Hebrew and Greek and Latin. That corresponds with what we know about Roman crucifixion practice. And the likelihood is that that is why he was being crucified. The Romans think that he's a royal pretender. And that's exactly the kind of thing that Romans crucify people for. Because to be a royal pretender, of course, is to dispute the authority of Caesar.
But then one other question on this, Tom, on the motive for the Romans crucifying him. A lot of people who are familiar with the story will know that Pontius Pilate famously doesn't really want to do it.
Washes his hands.
And then washes his hands of it and says, hence the phrase, and says, okay, fine, you want him dead, get on with it, it's nothing to do with me. I mean, to have that attitude and then to prescribe the ultimate punishment, the most hideous form of suffering, there seems to be a slight disjuncture between those two things. So Pontius Pilate doesn't really think Jesus is that bad a man, but says, okay, submit him to the worst torture imaginable. And that's quite a big leap.
Yeah, and people have said, I think correctly, that this is an attempt to spin it for a Roman audience.
Oh, right. So in other words, the Gospels are being written to try and convert Romans. And if the Romans are out and out baddies, it won't work. So Pontius Pilate has to be shown to be slightly...
Well, because the Gospels are probably being written in the wake of the Judean revolt, the Jewish revolt, maybe a bit before, a bit after, much debated, but around that time. And so Jews in rebellion against Caesar is not a good look. So this is something that has to be kind of spun quite carefully. Although having said that, the evidence of Pilate's term of office is that he does work hand in glove with the authorities in Jerusalem, who would as effectively are the priests. So that idea of a kind of liaison between the priests and Pilate is not impossible. But the idea of Pilate, who seems to have been very robust in his approach to rebels, washing his hands and all that kind of stuff, that really does seem to be, a kind of slight whitewashing. But again, having so other things I think that are likely to be true, because it, why wouldn't they be? Simon of Cyrene, who you mentioned, helping Jesus with the cross, that seems to be true, not least because in Mark, he says that Simon of Cyrene's sons are well known to the Christian community. So he's unlikely to be saying that, if the whole story is just completely made up.
Right. So why would they get, are we to believe that Simon of Cyrene is an adherent of Jesus?
That seems to be the implication.
Right.
That seems to be the implication. Yeah.
And all the stuff with the robes, the scarlet robe, the crown of thorns, all of that is part of the humiliation process.
Yeah. So that seems entirely possible.
Yeah.
The fact that he gets crucified at a place called Golgotha, which, as I said, you know, it's the only reference to it that we have. That seems a very specific reference.
Kind of the execution ground outside the city.
Yeah, the place of the skull, supposedly. Women at the feet of the cross, perhaps. I mean, again, it's kind of detail that, you know, why would someone make it up?
That would be plausibly a bit like the sort of the getting the front seats at a hanging at Tyburn or the tricoteurs at the guillotine. Is it in
seven? Well, no, because they're
plausible?
They're not there to enjoy it. You know, this is Mary and Mary Magdalene, and they're mourning it.
But it's plausible, isn't it, that there must have been people there who were there to enjoy it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole point of it.
You would imagine that public executions drew crowds.
Yes, absolutely.
And that there would be real kind of, and not quite, groupies is not the right word, but the real enthusiasts of public suffering.
Crucifixion fans. Well, and the gospel says much. You know, they say that people stand there and jeer and mock him and say, well, you know, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross.
Yes.
That mockery is a part of the narrative. I think the story of Joseph Arimathea, again, you know, where does this come from if not from...
So he's the guy who takes him down.
Yeah, so it's his tomb that Jesus' body is laid in.
Yeah, and he's another adherent, presumably.
Yes. The key aspect of this that does seem to be authentic is... And aside from the brute fact of the crucifixion, the fact that he was crucified on the order of the Romans, I think this is the third kind of key factor which massively influences the subsequent way that it's understood. He seems to have gone willingly to death. He does not fight against it. He seems to have surrendered to his fate in a way that impressed his followers and demanded to be understood and explained. And it's that kind of passive acceptance, the fact that he goes to his death like a lamb going to the sacrifice, that again, massively, massively influences the subsequent evolution of Christian history and theology.
Yeah, of course. But you think that adds to the veracity? Because you think if you made up the story, you'd have him fighting back or something?
I don't think it adds to the veracity, but I think it's likely to be a true detail. Okay. Because Paul mentions it. The Gospels mention it. It seems to have been fundamental to how Christians understood Jesus and his fate right from the very beginning.
And then Tom, okay, so I completely accept your argument that it really happened. I don't know, I'm not enormously well informed about this, but it seems implausible to me that you've got four different accounts that have completely invented. I mean, there's actually no real example I can think of.
No.
In history from this period of sources being completely wildly invented. I mean, I know we've had Ptolemy and his talking snakes previously in the podcast, but that was one detail in an otherwise true story.
Yeah, and I think that because this is in the Bible, and because for some people it's holy writ, you know, infallible, and for other people it's evidence of kind of mumbo jumbo and superstition and therefore has to be disproved, these are passages that are far more contested than any other, you know, parallel pieces of writing from ancient history. But essentially, you know, there's no difference.
Yeah.
As you know, you can read a passage that describes someone you know existed, you know, a god appearing to him. You know, we did the Rubicon, Caesar standing on the banks of the Rubicon. We know that this is attested by people who saw it, and yet you get in the accounts, you know, accounts of kind of mysterious figures playing the pipes and all that kind of stuff. So it's no different with this. The fact that there are supernatural elements within it doesn't discount the fact that other elements of the accounts may be, you know, are likely to be true.
Agreed. Because, of course, if we were to cast out all sources with supernatural elements, there'd be nothing left from, you know, before the 17th century or something.
Absolutely. And also in the context of antiquity, to have sources that reference this event within 20 years of it happening, so Paul's letters, and detailed narrative accounts, so the Gospels, that's, let's say, 40 to 60 years after the events, you know, by the standards of ancient history, these are really good. You know, we talked about this in the context of Alexander the Great.
I was about
or Muhammad. Yeah. You know, these... Yeah. If you cut, you know, I came to the gospel accounts from studying the sources for the life of Muhammad, and I couldn't believe how close in time they were.
Yeah. So, Tom, Let's just start to move. We don't want to exhaust our listeners' patience completely. So let's move through the subsequent history. At what point would you say does the act of crucifixion become indelibly associated with Jesus? So in other words, in AD 100, when people think about crucifixion in the Roman world, they probably don't think of Jesus.
No.
So at what point does that change?
Even in the second century, Christian apologists are saying, you know, that, yeah, this is really embarrassing. They find it awkward. And I think it's very telling that although Christians do write about it, they don't seem to have illustrated it. And the people who do illustrate it are either mocking them. So there's a famous piece of graffiti from Rome, which it shows a donkey, a man with a donkey's head being crucified. And the wording is Alexamenos worships his god, which is obviously a kind of, you know, a mockery of Christians. And magicians start to use it in their spells. They start to illustrate crosses, trying to invoke the Christian god. By the fourth century, of course, the cross absolutely comes to be associated with the figure of Jesus, not least because
God appears to Constantine.
Because it appears to Constantine.
Yeah. So is that the point at which the cross stopped? So with Constantine, and then I suppose, I don't know, Theodosius the Great or something, is that the point at which the cross becomes, because it starts to connote something very different, doesn't it? There's a point at which the cross becomes a symbol of power and a symbol of the state rather than a symbol of being a loser.
It's always been a symbol of power and of the state. That's what it is for the Romans.
Good point.
The paradox of the cross is that it effectively completely reverses that narrative, because it's saying, you know, Jesus has triumphed over those who've killed him. The slave has triumphed over the master. The tortured person has triumphed over the torturers. That's the kind of paradox of it. And although you're right that, of course, when, you know, with this sign conquer, that's what Constantine sees in his dream, and the cross becomes an emblem of power for the Roman emperor. The fact that it was an emblem of torture, that's not something that they can get rid of. And they still, you know, they're still struggling with it right the way through into the fifth century. So in the British Museum, there's an ivory that shows Jesus on the cross. And this is the first time that the crucifixion has been portrayed by a Christian artist, so far as we know.
Wow. Amazing.
And Jesus on that cross is shown basically, you know, like a kind of competitor from Love Island. He's buff and honed, and essentially what he's an athlete who has won. Yeah. He's won, you know, in the Olympics. That's what he is. And his face is absolutely serene. And that's the tradition that then passes into Byzantine art and orthodoxy. The idea that Christ on the cross is serene in victory. He's a victor. But in the West, that tradition becomes different. And by the turn of the millennium, you're starting to get sculptures of Jesus being shown dead on the cross. And then over the course of the Middle Ages, increasingly, he's shown as suffering the degree of torture and agony that he would have done. And that becomes fundamental to the way that Latin Christians understand Jesus and his suffering. And the passion, so, you know, his suffering, becomes kind of fundamental to medieval Christian religious practice.
But in the East, it's the image of Christ triumphant, isn't it? Christ, the sort of image, they don't seem to revel in the idea of Christ, the underdog, to the same degree. I suppose partly, is that not because the Christ and Christianity is so closely identified with the autocracy in, let's say, Constantinople, and then I suppose in Moscow? You know, the idea of there's no separation of church and state. So you wouldn't show the emperor as suffering.
Yes, perhaps, but I think it's more theological. It's more the weight that you put on Christ's human suffering, mm-hmm. which in Latin Christendom becomes fundamental to religious practice and to theology. So St. Anselm, who becomes Archbishop of Canterbury under William the Conqueror, he writes about seeing Christ on the cross and feeling this incredible agony and asking, you know, why was I not there? Why did I not feel a sword stab through my heart as Christ's side was pierced by the spear? Why did I not feel the nails driven through my hands and feet? And this becomes something that expresses itself through artwork, through theology, through meditation. And that becomes kind of very, very important to the specifically Latin and then Western practice of Christianity. But I think, ironically, one of the long-term consequences of that is that ultimately people in the West become desensitized to the horror of it. Because in a sense, the cross is so key to Christian practice that people start just to see it as a symbol without reflecting on the full horror of what it represents.
I think that's absolutely true. The cross is ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Because it's ubiquitous, we don't see it as an instrument. We don't see it as a kind of form, like, you know, a much worse rack or something.
It's a horrible
thumbscrew. It's a torture instrument, but we don't see it as that anymore.
It's a horrible, horrible thing. I think the subject is a fairly revolting and upsetting one. And I think properly understand the impact that the idea of a crucified savior had in the early centuries of Christianity, you have to grasp that, you have to get that, you have to feel it. And ironically, you know, of all the people who've written about Christianity and the figure of Christ over, say, the past 200 years, I think the thinker who most profoundly understood how kind of wrenching and weird the centrality of the cross is to Christianity was probably the West's most notorious atheist, Friedrich Nietzsche, who saw in the valorization of the victim on the cross something that he came to see as revolting, because it served to kind of sap, as he saw it, and destroy the strength and power that he identified classical civilization as embodying.
Yeah, he saw the cross as a symbol of servility and suffering and kind of wallowing in. Mm. I mean, what would he say now if he had his own? I can imagine Nietzsche as this sort of incredibly intemperate, permanently cancelled podcaster talking about wallowing in victimhood. But that's what the cross does.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, it's a slave morality, he famously says.
Yeah.
You know, that this the valorization of slaves and victims. You know, and he would absolutely, you know, he would look at the Western world in 2022 and absolutely identify it as being completely Christian in its concern for, you know, because
he would make Jordan Peterson look like the most wishy-washy.
So if you think yourself back into a world that was capable of crucifying slaves and see that as a public good, that is to recognize that saying, you know, assuming that the execution of slaves is somehow inherently, fundamentally, totally wrong, is culturally illiterate, historically illiterate. It hasn't been seen as that for across vast swathes of the world, vast periods of time. And that is what Nietzsche kind of focuses on. So and it's specifically this idea, the paradox, he calls it, the formula, God on the cross. Hitherto, he writes, there had never and nowhere been such boldness in inversion, nor anything at once so dreadful, questioning and questionable as this formula. It promised a transvaluation of all ancient values. And he sees it as ushering in a sick, victim-obsessed world that he was revolted by. But I think that it's precisely the scale of Nietzsche's contempt for Christianity that draws attention to how Christian we in the West remain to this day. And we remain, you know, the cross is fundamental to that, the idea of the crucifixion.
For people who find that argument interesting and have not maybe heard it before, presumably have never listened to one of our podcasts before, Tom, is there any reading material you can recommend that they might enjoy on this subject?
There is. It is my own recently published book, Dominion, which is
It was mean of me to get you to do that. I should have done it myself. Tom's book, Dominion, is all about Christianity's impact on human history. So it's not a Christian book as in Tom is a Christian who's trying to convert you. It's explaining how Christianity has seeped into all kinds of things without us even noticing it, and what a revolution that was. So one last point, Tom. I mean, this is an absolutely fascinating subject. When and why did crucifixion die out Was it sort of once the Roman Empire became Christian, was it impossible to keep crucifying people because it was obviously reminiscent of Jesus's fate?
Yeah, so it gets banned by Constantine, who's converted to Christianity. You know, he says, "Yeah, we're not going to have that." But it never fades completely from the Near East. So the Persian emperors continue to do it, and it is mandated in the Quran as a punishment for those who are rebels against God and His Prophet. And so, with the establishment of the Caliphate, crucifixion returns as a punishment to the lands of the Caliphate, and that's why the Islamic State, for instance, you know, the past decade when they established their inverted commas Caliphate, they reintroduced crucifixion as a Quranically mandated punishment. So. It's not completely gone.
That's terrifying, isn't it? When you think that it's a punishment deliberately designed to cause as much suffering as possible and to humiliate and so on. We have maybe travelled less far than we thought.
I know I've talked about this, and I know makes me out to be incredibly brave.
The great thing it shows you not just. As I said to you when you threatened before the podcast that you would bring this up, I said, it's brilliant because it doesn't just make you look very brave. It makes you look very kind and compassionate. So you win.
It does dominate. Yes, it does. I win every way.
In stark contrast to the cynicism and callousness in Chipping Norton.
I know Nietzsche would spin in his grave this. I mention it simply because this was a documentary I made about what Islamic State did to Christians and to Yazidis, who are a religious minority in northern Iraq. And I went out there assuming that I wasn't going to have to go anywhere near the Islamic State. And due to a complicated concurrence of factors, I ended up in a taxi going to the front with the Islamic State to a town called Sinjar, where the Yazidis had lived, that had just been taken back by the Kurds. And because I was out there making this documentary, I had no choice but to go. So it wasn't my courage that took me there. In fact, the brave thing would have been to say, "I'm too scared, I'm not going." I just kind of got swept along.
It was your cowardice in the face of the production coordinator.
Yes, we've all been there. So we ended up in this town where there are stories that Yazidi men were crucified there. And we were a mile or so away from the Islamic State, the people who'd done this. And I felt this kind of existential terror because suddenly I was within kind of mortar range of people for whom the cross did not serve as a symbol of what it served for me, of the triumph of the weak over the strong, but of the opposite, of the right of the strong to torture to death the weak. And it took me back to a Roman world. It took me back to a world in which Roman imperial authorities kind of exercised that sense of authority and power. And so I was writing Dominion at the time when I made that film. I came back and I rewrote the opening to focus on the crucifixion and what crucifixion had meant to the Romans and the revolution in understanding that the history of Christianity embodies, because to reiterate, I do think it is profoundly, profoundly influential on the whole course of Western civilization and how we are influenced by it to this day.
Brilliant. All right. Thank you, Tom. You've persuaded me. And I imagine you're not persuaded. I'm glad you weren't crucified.
Thanks. That's the sweetest thing you've ever said.
Yeah, otherwise I'd be doing this podcast with who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, write in. No, that was absolutely fascinating. And I think we never do dwell on the horrible suffering that the crucifixion involved. And next year we can do the same with Easter eggs.
the other horror of Easter.
Right. So on that bombshell, thank you very much for listening. I hope you get the Easter Bunny brings you all you desire. And we will see you after Easter with some more historical delights. Goodbye.
Happy Easter. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.